Hello, welcome to Oldham Village. Today is Monday, July 20th, 1998. In the Creekside room this morning is Anna Marie Pineda. Today's session number is 98-5, and it is titled The Experience and Significance of Guadalupe for Hispanics. Let's listen in.
Central America in El Salvador, and came to the States when I was 2 years old, and grew up in the San Francisco Mission District, which is the area of San Francisco where you have the Hispanic or the Latino community, which was always great fun. It was really great fun growing up in that area, because I found out very early on that to be Hispanic wasn't one thing, it was many things. We had like 22 different countries represented. So we always could tell when we had any exchanges, even the different flavors of Spanish. And of course, everyone claimed that they had the best articulation of the language. But it was a wonderful experience. Today, what I'm going to share with you is something about a very important spiritual presence in the Hispanic community, or spiritual reality, which is that of Our Lady Guadalupe. There's much to say about her, and we only have a short time, and I generally like to leave some time open for conversation and questions and discussion, and I will do so today, but perhaps a little less, because I think it might be helpful to give a broader context for a devotion or a spiritual reality in the Hispanic community, which is not always known outside of that community. It's almost impossible to really understand the significance of Our Lady Guadalupe without spending a little bit of time in the historical context, because it's within that historical context that she makes sense. If you take that away, it's difficult to grasp the full significance. So we have to go back to 1492. Columbus sailed the ocean blue. We all learned a phrase. Well, it was a very significant voyage, because that voyage altered what we know today of much of history, and altered a whole civilization, which was that of the indigenous peoples here in these lands. Columbus came, of course, seeking riches, and Spain had its own concerns, not only riches, but it wanted to spread Christianity, because it was coming out of an 800-year conquest themselves of the Moorish presence. And they felt that during that time, the Moorish peoples had tainted their lands, had brought in an idolatrous religion, and that it was no longer possible to formulate an orthodox expression of Christianity in a land that was tainted. So they had concerns and an interest in being able to do it elsewhere. And this elsewhere was provided by the new lands that Columbus would discover. And of course, the word discovered is always in quotes, because it was there. He just happened to kind of bump into it and said he had discovered it. That's always a little a bone of, you know, great debate and conversation. The conquest of the new lands is gradual. It doesn't happen all of a sudden. And I can't go into that because there's too much detail, but enough to say that by 1519, Cortes has managed to arrive to the capital of what was the Aztec hub, Mexico City, today's Mexico City. By 1521, there's a major battle that takes place there, and Cortes renders the final defeat of a whole civilization of the indigenous people. And that defeat that takes place, it is recorded by one of the indigenous historians, who says that 24,000 warriors were killed. But that doesn't include the number of women and children and others that were killed in the main battle and subsequent battles that occur. The account of the defeat is so terrible and devastating that later it's recorded by some of the survivors of that conquest, that moment of conquest, and they describe it as so devastating that the people were starving. They were literally forced to eat the clusters of grass and weeds that were on the ground, because there was no food and the people were starving. the water canals that surrounded the area that was the capital of Mexico City were bloodied with the blood of those that were killed and filled with the bodies of those that were killed. And the account, which is in a very poetic form, goes on to say that the children are left orphaned and you can hear the cries of the children. And the assault of women who were taken and raped, and the temples are knocked down and burnt wherever that was possible. The wise men are the men that carried the history of the peoples, which was a very important tradition in the community since it depended on oral communication of this history in order for the generations, subsequent generations, to know something of their identity. These wise men were killed, and I think very wisely in one way, because they had the whole memory of their people, but also their religious traditions. And later, we do hear of the burning of the painted books. The indigenous people had two ways of communicating, which were part of their system of communication. And this is extremely important because it does enter later into the Guadalupe story. The two ways of doing it was first oral tradition, which was entrusted to these wise men. They spent a lifetime from childhood learning how to memorize in a certain way so that they could have the whole account of their peoples passed down. And the other way of communicating, or the other way that made up the system of communication, was the paintings, the drawings that they had. And the drawings were so intricate and so complex that not only did the wise men have to understand the significance of color and form and shape, but they also had to have a whole group of workers to help them do it, like painters. The artists were very well respected in the community because they made it possible for this history to continue. So these books are eventually burned, and I think to this day, only around 50 of them survive. That might not be a totally accurate number, but it's still about that number. The defeat and the experience of conquest is so terrible that the people want to die. There's nothing left for them. And it's recorded that in one moment, what they say is, "Please let us die. Let us disappear, for our gods have died." And the reason that this is important is because their whole world was based on the activity and the power of the gods. And so they felt that their gods had been defeated by a stronger god, and that everything that made it possible for them to live had been destroyed. So there was nothing left for them other than to die. And historically, there are even accounts of some kind of suicides that occur because the people do not want, there's no reason for them to continue. In 1523, 1524, the first official missionaries come to the new land. They're Franciscans, and they're called the 12 or the 12. And they are supposed to emulate the example of the 12 disciples of Jesus. And they are imbued with this incredible enthusiasm that they're beginning on this mission that God has sent them on, and that they are going to create almost a new heaven and a new earth with this missionary activity. The first thing that they do when they arrive is Cortes manages to convince them that they are to spend time putting together like a doctrine or a catechism, and that they are to preach this doctrine to the indigenous peoples as the first act of evangelization, which they do. And they were very intelligent men. They had been prepared extremely well. And they spend approximately 10 days just writing this doctrine, which is later known as the Colloquies. And then they set up a moment of encounter with the remainder of the wise people that had been killed. They were like students who had been preparing to take that task on. And in this exchange, the Franciscan missionaries begin to tell them the doctrine of how they come to preach one God and how their king, which is the Pope, has sent them, and so forth and so forth. and all the wise men do is listen. And at the very end, one of them who has been selected by the group stands up. And I'm going to read you parts of the exchange. I think it tells us a lot about the sense of loss and devastation that they were feeling. The indigenous people were extremely respectful. That was a value that was very highly esteemed and regarded. So he gets up, and the very first thing he does is to thank them for coming and to acknowledge that the trip that they undertook was probably a very torturous one, and so that they recognize that they had also suffered in coming to this new land. Our lords are very esteemed lords. Great hardship have you endured to reach this land. Here before you, we ignorant people contemplate you. Ignorant because they feel that they're not the ones that have been fully prepared to be the wise men, that they were just the students. Through an interpreter, we reply. We exhale the breath and the words of the Lord of the close vicinity. So even the breath that we have, the words that we have been given to us by our God, the Lord of the close vicinity. Because of him, we dare to do this. For this reason, we place ourselves in danger. You said that we know not the Lord of the close vicinity, to whom the heavens and the earth belong. You said that our gods are not true gods. New words are these that you speak. Because of them, we are disturbed. Because of them, we are troubled. For our ancestors before us, who lived upon the earth, were unaccustomed to speak thus. From them have we inherited our pattern of life, which in truth did they hold, in reverence they held. They honored our gods, they taught us all their rules of worship, all their ways of honoring the gods. Thus before them do we prostrate ourselves, in their names we bleed ourselves. Bleeding was a form of like offering. Our oaths we keep, incense we burn, and sacrifices we offer. It was with the doctrine of the elders that there is life because of the gods. With their sacrifice they gave us life. In what manner, when, where, when there was still darkness. And then it continues. We know on whom life is dependent, on whom the perpetuation of the race depends, by whom beginning is determined, by whom growth is made possible, how it is that one must invoke, how it is that one must pray. Hear, O lords, do nothing to our people that will bring misfortune upon them, that will cause them to perish. Calm and amiable, consider, O lords, whatever is best. We cannot be tranquil, and yet we certainly do not believe. We do not accept your teachings as truth, even though this may offend you. Here are the lords, those who rule, those who sustain, whose duty is to the entire world. Is it not enough that we have already lost, that our way of life has been taken away, has been destroyed? In the colloquies, this is really the final recorded exchange between the wise men and the missionaries. Part of the reason that it's the final word is because the original colloquies is lost and part of it destroyed. So we only have a fragment of it. But we do know that after this exchange, they tell them that they're going to go back and to have this conversation with the community to discuss it and to see what their reply is, and that they will come back in a couple of days. And when they go back to their community, they are, when they begin to tell those that are gathered what the exchange was all about and the content of the exchange, the people, according to the recorded account, fall into a stupor. They are so overwhelmed with the news and so overcome. But what they finally come to in terms of an agreement is that what else have they? They've lost everything. They cannot accept the God that is being preached, and that they are dead, that this is the end result. So this is the devastation that is experienced by the people. And subsequently, the missionary activity continues. The indigenous peoples are baptized. And they're given some type of preparation for baptism. As some of the missionary groups had a more detailed way of doing it, but it was a whole process of conversion and teaching of the Christian faith. 10 years after the conquest, which occurs in 1521, there's a significant event that occurs that is going to change the whole possibilities of the future for the indigenous peoples. And it's in 1531. It takes place on a Saturday morning, December the 9th. And this is going to be what is considered the Guadalupe event. It's not just an appearance, it's a whole event that is put into motion by what follows. There is an Indian named Juan Diego who is preparing to be baptized and received into the Catholic or Christian faith. And he is on his way to Mexico City, where the missionaries held their activity of evangelization. But he's coming from the mountain area, the mountain region. And there is a little place where he has to cross that's extremely important, at least to the account. You can imagine here's Mexico City. There used to be a large temple, but now there's the church. He's coming down this way. It takes them a long time to travel down from the outskirts of Mexico City to come for catechism or religious instruction. It's very early in the morning. And as he comes around a little hill called Tepeyac, he is struck by beautiful music that he hears. It's a metaphor. The account uses a lot of symbolism and metaphors that help us understand something of the way that the indigenous people communicated truth. He's struck immediately by the music, because in the indigenous world, music and flower, that expression, flor y canto, were expressions of the spiritual. Something very important is going to happen. So he stops. And he begins to talk out loud to himself, and he's wondering, what is this? Have I been transported to another reality? Am I no longer here on earth, or is it the heavenly reality that my ancestors spoke about? But it's not our understanding of heavenly. It's their understanding of another moment of reality, of the spiritual. When he stops, he suddenly hears a voice that calls out, and the voice says to him, and the account is that it's a very gentle, inviting voice. Juanito, Juan Dieguito. Today we have some studies that indicate to us that probably the voice actually said Juan Sin. There's a Z-I-N ending, which means you who are of great worth. So Juan Sin. So it would be like Ana Sin, you who are of great worth. But in the Spanish translation, they put Juanito. So it's Juan Sin, Juan Sin. And he goes to where the voice is calling him, not very afraid to approach this voice because it is an inviting voice. And when he gets there, he sees an extremely beautiful woman standing and waiting for him. He is overcome by her beauty, and she begins to talk to him. The key is she begins to talk to him in his indigenous language. And they have this little exchange, and she says to him that she's chosen him for a very special test, that where she is standing, she wants a temple built or a church built, and she wants him to go and make this known to the bishop. So for some very odd reason, this Indian who has been defeated, who has nothing much to really call worth living for, just with that exchange, thinks that he can do it, or thinks that he should do it. So he takes off, continues his journey, goes to the house of the bishop, which in the account is called the palace of the bishop. It shows the difference between those who had been defeated and those who were now in power. And it wasn't just the church, it was also the crown. And he's made to wait for a very long time by the servants. The servants are also indigenous. So not only have you been defeated by a conquering people, but you've also been in some ways disregarded by your own. This is the level of defeat that's experienced. And finally, he's allowed to come in to talk to the bishop, and he tells the bishop that he has seen this very beautiful lady who is asking that a temple be built where she's standing. So the bishop wants a full account and goes ahead and asks him several questions. And in the end, he says, you know, my son, why don't you come back another day and tell me in more detail? I'm very busy, and come back another day. So it's very clear that his word has not been believed. So Juan Diego leaves very distressed, and he goes back and he encounters the lady a second time. And the lady says, she encourages him, you have to go back. And here's this exchange. Let's see what I have here. When he sees her, he says, my dear child, I went where you sent me to fulfill your mandate. It was with great difficulty that I entered the room of the bishop. I gave him your message just as you had told me to do. He received me kindly and he heard me attentively, but he did not believe as true what I told him. He told me to come again and he would hear me out slowly. My dear lady, I understood perfectly well in the way in which you responded that he believes that perhaps it's an invention of mine that you wanted to build you a temple here. This I beg you, entrust your mission to one of the important persons who is well known, respected, and esteemed, so that they may believe him. You know that I am a nobody, a nothing, a coward, a pile of old sticks, just like a bunch of leaves. I am nothing. You have sent me to walk in places where I do not belong. Forgive me, and please do not be angry with me, my lady and mistress. And she responds, listen, my son, the smallest of my children. And that expression, she's trying to say to him, I know of your defeated heart. I know how you feel. You're the smallest of my children. You are one of the oppressed. I want you to understand that I have many servants and messengers to whom I can entrust this message. But in every aspect, it is precisely my desire that you seek help so that with your mediation, my wish will be fulfilled. And she goes on to beg of him to please help her in this mission. And in the whole exchange that will continue between the lady and Juan Diego, we begin to see a transformation of this defeated Indian. He begins to take on a courage and a spirit that had not been part of him prior to this encounter. So he goes back a second time. And when he goes back a second time, he's asked again to wait for a very long time. And the servants make him wait even longer this time around. And all the exuberance that he carries in his heart to bring this message is slowly kind of taken out of him, so that by the time he gets to see the bishop, he is no longer the brave Juan Diego that has started out in the second moment of this mission. But he proceeds and he tells the bishop again of the request of the lady. And this time, the bishop says, I want a sign. Please go back and ask the lady to send me a sign. And Juan Diego goes, what kind of sign? But the bishop doesn't wait to ask, to respond to the question, what kind of sign? He just dismisses him. And this time, the bishop is even more fearful and suspicious of Juan Diego. So he sends out his servants to follow him. And in the account, there's a symbolism that occurs. As the servants can see Juan Diego, as long as they're still in the area of where the capital of Mexico City and the capital of the missionary activity is situated. But as soon as he begins to cross over and goes back over by Tepeyac, they lose sight of him. symbolically, they no longer have hold of him, because when he's back in his own territory, back where the presence of the lady is, he again is more of a person. He has more strength, more courage. So he tells the lady, "I'm sorry, it's been terrible, I haven't been able to do it again." And she says, "Don't worry, tomorrow I'll come back and I will give him the sign that he's asking for." One day he goes home and discovers when he goes home that his uncle is very ill. His uncle is close to death. And his uncle says to him, "Juan Diego, I'm dying. I need to see one of the priests to come and attend to me in my death." The missionary priests are the only thing they have left. They no longer have their own. So Juan Diego is left with this dilemma. On the one hand, he's promised the lady he's going to come back the next day so he can take the sign. On the other hand, he has this incredible obligation to his uncle who is dying to fulfill his request. So the way he solves it, or he thinks he's going to solve it, is the next morning he decides, first, I'll run quickly to Mexico City, get the priest that my uncle is asking for because he is on the verge of death, and then I will go back and talk to the lady and see what she wants to send the mission. But Juan Diego, as he approaches the little hill of Tepeyac, decides that if he takes the same route, she's going to see him. And then he's going to have to render an explanation. And he's not prepared for this explanation. So he takes another little route, and he goes around the opposite direction of the little hill. But in the account, the lady is at the top, and she's watching him circle. And when he circles, what he does is run into her anyway, because she comes down the hill, and she's in his pathway. So he sees her, and I love this this exchange. It reminds me of so many times in my own life that I'm sure you can identify, when you have been caught doing something that you haven't been expected to do. As he was going by the other side of the hill, in order to avoid her, he saw the lady coming down from the top of the hill, and coming to him said, "What's happening, my son, the smallest of my children? Where are you going?" He became very embarrassed and, greeting her, said, "My dear lady, I hope you are happy. Did you sleep well? I am going to cause you some affliction. I want you to know that my uncle is ready to die," and then proceeds to tell her what's happening. But in the exchange, it's very amusing. Did you sleep well? How are you? Everything else, but you know, what was really happening. So she says, "You know, my son," I delight because it's like, I can identify so well. She says, "My son, what are you worried about? Don't you realize that I am your refuge, I am your consolation, I take care of you, I take care of all those who come to me and are in affliction. Where is your hope? Where is your trust? And don't you know that even as you and I are speaking, your uncle is already cured. And what you need to do is what I want you to do, and it's the following." So with this exchange, he becomes once again trusting that what the lady is saying is true. She goes, "You are to go to the top of the hill, and when you reach the top of the hill, you will find the flowers. You're going to cut them, and you are to bring them down to me, and then you are to proceed to give them to the bishop." The request in itself sounds very simple. However, there are some elements that make it extraordinary, and that is that the hill of Tepeyac is a rocky hill. You only have weeds that grow there. You don't normally have flowers that grow there. And it is winter, so that would make it even less feasible that you would have a growth of flowers. But he doesn't seem to question the request, or even that some of these circumstances would make it difficult to make it a reality. He goes up to the top of the hill, and sure enough, he just sees this beautiful array of roses that still are wet with the dew of the early morning. And he cuts them. And as he cuts them, he just delights in the fragrance of the roses. And he puts them into his what is called a thimba, that's like a tunic, like a serape, made of coarse weave, almost like burlap. And he puts him into this thimba, and he brings up the thimba to his chest, comes down, opens up the thimba, and shows it to the lady. And she takes the roses from the thimba, handles each one of them in the account, puts them back into the thimba, and says to him, "Take these roses to the bishop. This is a sign. But you are not to show it to anyone, only to the bishop." He has a very long way to go from the hill to Mexico City, the capital. And in the account, there's a very beautiful rendering of how on the entire way to Mexico City, he is just not only joy-filled, but intrigued and just intoxicated with the fragrance of the roses. So every once in a while he stops and he lets a little bit of the fragrance come out and he smells it, and then he continues on his way. And he's so happy, just feeling so courageous and so happy that finally he has something to bring to the bishop. And he gets to the palace of the bishop again, and once again the servants make him wait, but this time they make him wait even more because they're angry that they lost sight of him the last time around. And he's standing there with such exuberance, and as the time goes by, he just becomes less and less certain of himself. And the account tells us that he just begins to kind of slump over, like losing the posture of one who feels full of dignity and full of courage and of himself, of certainty. And the servants notice that he has something, and they keep wondering what it is, and they keep trying to tease him to let them see what he has. And finally, they manage, or he just discloses a little, like an edge of the thimba, and they see flowers, but when they go to seize them, they can't like grasp the flowers. Metaphorically, we have the music in the beginning of the account and now the flowers. And what it's saying is that there's a spiritual message that they cannot hold on to because it's not for them. And they are incapable of understanding what the message is. Finally, he comes in to see the bishop, and he kneels at his feet and he says, "I have the sign that you requested," and opens up his thimba, and the flowers, the roses, tumble out, and they fill the room with a fragrance. But the bishop initially is caught by the sight of the roses, but then on the second moment, what he realizes is that on the thimba there is the image of the lady that Juan Diego had the encounter with, which appears on the thimba in painted form. And with that, he falls on his knees and realizes his sin of distrusting and labeling this Indian as an ignorant, as someone not to be trusted. And on the heels of that, there is a request for a temple to be built on site. And the image is placed in that chapel or in that temple. So that is the account in brief form. But there's a lot of significance to it that we probably need to unpack a little bit. One of them is the indigenous peoples believed. We think they believed in many gods. And they did and they didn't. They had an understanding of God as one divine being with the name Ometeo. Ometeo had two dimensions to this divinity. One was the female dimension and the male dimension. And they always had to be joined together in order to describe the fullness of the divine. Because the divine was so other, so more than the human mind could grasp, they needed to find ways of talking about the God, the divine, Ometeo. So they would give the female dimension a series of titles, like we do ourselves, you know, Jesus is the Good Shepherd, Jesus is the Light. We have a variety of ways of describing. Well, they did the same, and they did the same for the male. The importance for us in this story is that the female dimension had many names. Some of them were the following. One was Tochi. Tochi. And one was Nanansi. And many others. Tochi meant grandmother, the grandmother of the old gods. Nanansi meant our venerable mother. And the lady appears on the side of the Beyak where there had been a very popular devotion to Tonantzin. That was a temple site for Tonantzin. And the indigenous people prior to the missionaries' arrival would go there in great numbers. So this event occurs there on the rock, on the temple remains that were once for Tonantzin. The lady herself appears in a mestiza form. She is not indigenous completely, but she's not European. She's a mix, and her appearance indicates that a new race has been produced between the Indian and the Spaniards, the mestiza, and she reflects this in her face, in her appearance. Some would say that when the missionaries arrived, they came preaching a God of love. At the same time, you had the conquerors, the conquistadores, killing by the droves, and with real brutal acts of violence against the Indian men and women. So that was very difficult for the Indians to put those two together and say, if you're talking about a God of love, and at the same time, there's mass killing, how is this possible? Because the crown and the cross were so intimately connected. And there is a real believable possibility or thought, if we want to even look for an explanation, that in this terrible moment of devastation and of destruction of a people, God, who is greater than any of us could ever imagine or conceive of, is not going to leave his people desolate and left with nothing. And so he sends a female appearance, apparition, a presence to be consoling, to be one that gives comfort to the people, who gives hope to the people, and with whom the people can identify more easily, because the male god, if you will, of the Christians did not hold that message. So I just offer that as a slight explanation. The lady, when she appears to Juan Diego, is in herself a painting. So when Juan Diego sees her, according to the way of communication that the people were used to, he could read her. She didn't even have to say, I am so and so, or this is what I'm doing. He just had to look at her. And the whole image of her tells him a story. First of all, she's a mestiza. She's wearing a turquoise mantle, which was the sign or the color of nobility, because colors had a lot of significance in the indigenous world. She is standing in front of the rays of the sun, and she's standing upon the moon. So the sun and the moon were the two symbols that were used to identify with the deity. So she, in some way, is revealing a spiritual message, a message of the divine, while she is neither the sun or the moon. She mediates the sun and the moon. Around her waist, there's a black belt. And this black belt is a maternity belt that the Indian women wore, which indicated that they were expecting a child. So she is expecting a child. Now, there's a couple of interpretations of that. One is she's expecting to give birth to Jesus, if you will, or God. She's also perhaps giving birth to a new people, to a new expression of humanity, but at the same time bestowing on it dignity, because there was a lot of fracturing in the indigenous community with the children who were born of all these unions. They were no longer one thing, they were no longer another. So there's a lot of symbolism behind the image itself. What do we know? There's a few more comments and then I'll open it up. Baptisms increased significantly after the event is supposed to have occurred. The Indians identified with the lady who's called Guadalupe. They think that she's called Guadalupe because when the bishop asked, what is her name? He gives her name in Nahuatl, which is the language in which the two of them have had their conversations. But the bishop, not knowing the language very well, connected it to what was more familiar, and that was Guadalupe, since there was not only a devotion to Our Lady of Guadalupe in Spain, the Spanish Guadalupe, but also there was a river, and that name was very popular. So she's given the name Guadalupe, and that name is still held today. She becomes significant to the mestizos, who see in her a reflection of themselves. And interestingly enough, she becomes very significant to the criollos, or to the children of the Spaniards who are born in Mexico, who are no longer, they feel themselves caught between two worlds. They don't know what Spain is like because they've never been there. And so they were Spanish enough to be considered Spaniards, but not enough to be considered, to be given power and responsibility. So they felt like they were occupying a middle position. And they could not identify with many of the customs and religious traditions that their own parents had in Spain. So Guadalupe speaks to them more as a new reality. Guadalupe becomes then a source of identity for the people. She helps the people form a new identity as a mestizo people, as a new national identity, which becomes the Mexican people. And she later is also used very often in moments of struggle. When Mexico wanted to get independence from Spain, one of the priests, Miguel Hidalgo, carries her banner in one of the first cries for independence from Spain. We know that in contemporary times, Cesar Chavez in the farm worker movement would often use Guadalupe in their strikes and in their processions and in their protests. And interestingly enough today, even the young, those who belong to gangs that are affiliated more to that level of their interaction with their peers, have Guadalupe stickers, have Guadalupe in their cars, have Guadalupe on their t-shirt. And so Guadalupe has become a real source not only of identity, but of hope and an expression of compassion, a protector in injustice, a symbol of solidarity with those who are poor and marginalized, and to this day carries incredible importance and force within the Mexican community primarily, but also for other Latin American peoples who see in her what I have tried to share with you and much, much more. So that is very, very briefly, is not only the account of Guadalupe, but giving some indications of her importance in the Latino community. So we have time for conversation or questions or comments or, yes?
Is the word mestizo mean a mixture, or does it mean an ability?
Mixture. Mestizo means the English and the Indian. But also shortly afterwards, you have the importation of African slaves to do the work that the indigenous peoples were trying to do and overused. so that the African slavery is brought into these lands, and you have the mix of African blood as well. In some places more predominant than in others. So it's mestizo mulatto.
Tell us about the account. Who wrote this? How do you know?
Because the people had the oral tradition account, the story is told. The story is passed down from one generation to the next. And eventually, one of the indigenous young men who had been trained in the Franciscan missionary school, where they were taught not only Spanish but also Latin, and they were also taught how to write Nahuatl. It's credited to Valeriano. He's one of these indigenous youth who they say put the oral account into written form, following the same use of metaphors and imagery that was very that was part of the indigenous way of communicating. So that's what we know. Now, the other thing that we also realize is that the account was probably spoken in Nahuatl first, and eventually you translate it from Nahuatl to Spanish. But we know that when you translate something, you can't always find the exact word, so you try and use the closest meaning to what you're looking for. So today there are a number of research efforts underway to try and go back to the more original, which is the Nahuatl, and to recover some of the more original meaning of the account. And I give you a couple of examples, like the Juan Sin is probably the more accurate than the Juanito. And the symbolism of the flor y canto, flower and song, is trying to tell us that something spiritual is about to happen. There's a spiritual event that is about to be revealed or manifested. But there's a lot more, even the symbolism.
So she didn't appear anymore then? She didn't appear again?
That's the event, but her significance continues to make itself manifest or revealed.
But hasn't she appeared to other people since then, since she's passed then, because of your account of Guadalupe appearing again, to visions to some people and such?
No,
but we're not talking about the same thing, probably.
Well, not Guadalupe. I think what has occurred is you have people that will attribute miracles to her and say, you know, I prayed to her, I asked her for help, and she answered my request. There's countless numbers of those. I just heard one last week. I was with a group of Latino students in theology in Emory, and an older man was telling me the story of how when he was younger, one of his children was born with a handicap, and he was told that his son would grow, but that he would always be hindered by this handicap, that they weren't even sure of how much mental abilities he would have. And that he and his wife promised to go to the shrine of Guadalupe, which is now Mexico City, the Basilica, where this image is held, and that he would make this trip to pray to her and ask for his son's health. And he went, and he said, it's not like my son was cured from his infirmities, but my son's life is more hopeful. There has been a change in even the way my wife and I think about it and in the way we relate to this child. So in that sense, you might say that there is this appearance, but not necessarily a physical appearance, but that she becomes manifest in the life of people.
Throughout the Southwest, there are personal shrines to Guadalupe in people's homes along the roads and things like that. And also, in the Southwest and in Mexico, many churches named.
And children. Countless.
Is there a festival or a celebration?
December the 12th is the day. And this is a very moving festival, a celebration. Following the importance of the account, where the appearance of Wadalupe takes place in the early dawn. And the significance of the early dawn is, or right before dawn, is that for the indigenous people, there was a very special moment of time, if you could even capture it, when night ceases to be night and becomes morning. That split second, I mean, if we stay up all night and we wait for that split second, I don't think we capture it. It's gone, because all of a sudden it's gone. But for the indigenous people, that split moment was a moment when new things were brought into creation. Transformation occurs. So it's at that moment that Juan Diego is having the encounter with the lady in the account. And it's at that moment that on December the 12th, people come to church to sing to Our Lady, to sing to Guadalupe. So very early in the morning, I lived in Chicago for 12 years. In December, it's cold. It is cold. And you go into a neighborhood and you see countless numbers of people coming out of their doors, out of their homes, carrying children wrapped up in blankets, older ladies and older men, young men as well. And you're all going to church because we know that that's her birthday, if you will. And we're going to sing her Las Mañanitas, which is the morning song. And it's a whole song that renders how Auguste she comes into our lives, and she's special. And it's a moment when flowers come into bloom. And it's a wonderful song. It's a Mañanitas. And you spend hours singing to her. You serenade her. And I have seen actually very moving manifestation of people's love and trust. And one day I went and I saw three businessmen, Mexican businessmen in a three-piece suit. I don't know how they could wear it in that heat, but they were wearing it with their briefcase. And on the side of them, indigenous peoples who had been traveling for days, you know, coming from the outer regions of the city, coming to worship her or to pray for her, to thank her. So December the 12th is an all-out day, and you spend it from morning to nighttime with different moments of celebration. It's a very special day because it recalls for us this event.
I have thought for some time that Our Lady of Guadalupe was the Blessed Virgin Mother. But you were careful not to, you did not say that.
Well, I'm
is
careful.
She viewed that way?
She's viewed that way, but I was careful because I'm trying to be true to the account. In the beginning of the account, he just refers to her as the lady. He doesn't give her a name. And it's not until later when they have this exchange that she begins to reveal more about herself. But in the account that we have in Spanish, she says, I am the ever virgin Mary, Mother of God. In the Nahuatl account, she says, I am the mother of the old gods. So it gives it a more indigenous context. But on the other hand, what I said earlier is, I mean, I believe God is infinitely greater than we can possibly understand. And in a time when the Indian people felt so defeated and devastated and could not identify with the Christian God and no longer had the gods because they had been destroyed and defeated in their understanding, there is this female manifestation of comfort, which we now refer to as Mary, the Mother of God. And at the same time, it has its indigenous roots.
I have a question about the name. Dave, you said that the original one asked what her name was, who gave it out. Do you know what that was?
Again, if I remember, I couldn't even pronounce it.
But do you know
it's
what
it is? It's an there are several possibilities. It could mean she who comes from the place of the eagles. And that has another very beautiful significance because in the indigenous world, the eagle was the animal that they felt had strength enough to come closer to the sun, and the sun was a symbol of the divine. It wasn't the divine, but it was a symbol for the sacred. So those who could come closer to the sun were those who could converse with the divine, who could mediate with the divine. So if the name she gave them meant them, that she is associated with the divine or with the sacred. She who could speak, you know, as an eagle with the divine.
Does Guadalupe itself mean?
No, Guadalupe is a Spanish tradition, but what we don't know is, well, they gave some possibilities of what the indigenous word could have been, but the bishop heard it, connecting it closer to what he knew, which was Guadalupe.
And does that have a meaning, Guadalupe?
I think place of the rivers, but that's in Spain.
Right.
But she's unique in being cited as a mestiza of a child. There's no other citing of that, of St. Mary.
Not of this particular image. No. You have like the Black Virgin, you know, of Poland.
Poland.
There's a virgin that's black, dark, and colored.
Okay.
But some of the virgins that are Marys that we know in other countries, their hue has been caused by other forces, like the burning of candles. But she's a mestiza, which is very different. It's a combination of two cultures in one.
What is her role within the Catholic Church? Is there an official acceptance of her?
Yes. She's been officially accepted in the Catholic Church as Guadalupe, as Mary, under that title. It didn't happen right away, but it did eventually happen.
Could you talk about your family a little bit? I mean, your ancestors in El Salvador, and this Christian faith that comes from a conquering experience. How did that come translated to you and your family?
I think what we have today is what sometimes has been referred to as a mestizo Christianity, because you have some indigenous customs and values with the Catholic tradition. You have, for example, devotion to the way of the cross. That is part of the Catholic Church's tradition, but the way it's celebrated in some ways is very indigenous. There are a lot of indigenous ways of manifesting that devotion to the suffering Christ. So we have that which the missionaries brought to us, but the way that we do it, the affectivity that accompanies it, the symbolism that accompanies it, a lot of it is rooted in our indigenous heritage. But it's difficult to separate because it's a mestizo, if you will, a blend of a number. Like, Guadalupe is not the Mary devotion that we have in Central America, but for me, she is. I mean, I have great devotion to her. So she kind of conquers you. You know, there's something very special about her. And probably because she is a mestizo, I can identify with it more than I could with that European image of Mary.
It sounds like she's a symbol for that whole blending of both traditions.
And not only a symbol, but a real a strong force. I mean, you see some of the oppressive situations that a lot of people live in, and she gives them hope. I mean, she gives them a way to battle with injustice or to be able to make things different, to transform. I mean, that was why the description that they read this morning is the transformation that occurs. And in many of the battles and struggles, Guadalupe is a very important force for people. Even to get a better job, even to try and get a job, even to deal with some of the discrimination, to make life better for your children and for your communities, she is that force.
It sounds like she's almost a vehicle for the continuation of our own culture. But it's very widespread.
And it's becoming more widespread. I went to Peru walked into a seminary, which was very indigenous, and they have an image of Our Lady of Guadalupe. I went in England, in Notre Dame Cathedral, they have a banner of Guadalupe. So, I mean, many different places. And unfortunately, we run out of time. Maybe I'd be happy to entertain your questions. I have time. But I just want, if anyone else has a different schedule, feel free.
I have a question about how you said that the wise men in training at this talk with the missionaries, and then the response was that they didn't want to accept this.
They couldn't.
But then the next thing is, here's this guy coming for the Christian training, and I'm wondering where's
Well, it happens gradually. What they were saying is that what you're telling us, we can't accept. But then the missionary efforts take place. In some cases, the Indians didn't have a lot of choice. You know, it was baptism or death. And in some other cases, they were instructed. And it's not like all the missionaries were terrible. I mean, that's not the case either. You know, we have that tendency to do it, think about it that way. And some of them took more care than others to evangelize. But what they do say is that after this event was, you know, recorded to have taken place, that there is a new outburst or birth of baptism that take place.
So you could say, in a way, this became a way that more people could accept the Catholic teaching.
She was the one inviting way to invite people. To go through the narrative itself is a whole 10-week course. Because it's just filled with wonderful symbolisms and meanings that help us understand a little bit more why she is so significant in the account. So I've only been able to give you like a thumbnail impression of it.
Wow.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a good day.